Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Hi, everybody. We need your help if you like this podcast. Make sure you subscribe if you're not already getting us every day. And tell your friends. Plus, leave us a rating and review on iTunes. It really helps us in a big way, and it helps other people find us. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. An average of 20 veterans die by suicide every day in this country, according to the Department of Veterans Affairs. In March of last year, former VA Secretary Dr. David Shulkin said this in an interview.
This is my highest clinical priority in the VA system. What we know about it is that of the 20 veterans who take their life every day, 14 are not getting care within the VA system. So we have to work with our communities to make sure that we're reaching out to veterans who aren't in a system of care to make sure that they are getting the care that they need.
But a new report just out from the Government Accountability Office says the VA has failed on a massive scale to address the problem. Among other failures, the report shows that only 1% of the $6.2 million set aside for advertising the VA crisis hotline was actually spent. And the consequences of this are real, says Iraq War veteran Christopher Goldsmith.
I am just so upset that there are veterans who may have died because they didn't know the VA was there for them. I mean, these outreach campaigns are the most important part of combating suicide.
We'll hear more from Christopher in a little bit. But first, to take us through the details of this report is Dave Phillips, national correspondent for The New York Times, covering veterans and the military. Dave, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me on.
One of the things that really stood out to me was the unspent money. We mentioned in the beginning that only 1% of $6.2 million has been actually used to advertise VA crisis hotline. What is going on there?
Right. This is their suicide prevention outreach program. And it's not just saying, hey, call the hotline. It's sending out messages that reduce stigma, let people know the warning signs. Essentially, it is the door that the VA tries to open, the front door welcome mat to say, hey, we're here for you. If you need us, come get help. And they had about $6 million just for outreach, radio spots, billboards, commercials on TV, and only 57,000 of it got spent in sort of the year preceding this report. So from this summer back to last summer, and almost all of the money was just sat doing nothing as these public service announcements went dead.
Do we know why this money wasn't spent?
Well, what the government report, the Government Accountability Office's report says is that essentially there was no one left in charge. And so confusion and delay, meetings that no one went to sort of took over. And when that happened, there was no one there to sort of stamp the paper that said, yes, go ahead and spend this money. And so it was sort of bureaucratic paralysis set in.
I'm wondering whether or not this also had something to do with the role of VA leadership. Of course, we heard from Dr. Shulkin at the top of this segment, who said that this was a clear priority for him, veteran suicides. He was fired in March, and he was replaced by Robert Wilkie. Is that a factor in all of this?
That's part of it, but that what happened to Dr. Shulkin has really happened at a number of levels in the central office. So not only is your top executive being fired and then disarray setting in for several months before a new replacement is picked, but all sorts of people that are at high level and medium level leadership positions within the VA, they left since the Trump administration because there has been an atmosphere of divisiveness and partisanship that's really kind of unheard of at the VA. The VA is supposed to be kind of a very boring bureaucracy that churns out benefits. So a number of people that knew what they were doing, that had plans in place and were running things like suicide prevention, kind of threw their hands up and left. And at a number of different projects, there's been breakdowns like this.
Let's talk a little bit about, outside of the advertising budget and the public service announcements, or lack thereof, what were some other numbers that really stood out to you in this report, Dave?
Well, I mean, the first thing that we need to say is that suicide is a really big problem for especially young war veterans. Their suicide rate is 3 times higher than the national average. And like Dr. Shulkin said in the clip that you played at the beginning, the vast majority of those who die are not getting VA care. So there's this huge gap where outreach can bring people in, get them better care, get them better support. And that's not happening. You know, the other thing that's amazing is how steep the drop-off was in their outreach. You know, they were doing thousands of PSAs, public service announcements, every year, all over the country, and that literally went silent. In the year leading up to the report, the GAO couldn't find a single one of these PSAs that had been aired. So it just went limp. It's crazy how much it dropped off.
Dave Phillips is a national correspondent for the New York Times, covering veterans and the military. Dave, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Let's ask a veteran about all this.
My name is Christopher Goldsmith, and I am the Assistant Director for Policy and Government Affairs at Vietnam Veterans of America, and I'm the founder and president of High Ground Veterans Advocacy.
Christopher Goldsmith is also an Iraq war veteran.
I am a survivor of suicide. I've struggled with PTSD since I got home from Iraq after a year over there in 2005, and the VA saved my life. You know, it took a lot of time and a lot of effort, but it was a great tool for me. You know, at the age of 21, after being a sergeant, I went back to my childhood bedroom in my mom's house. You know, and I'm thankful that my parents took me back, but, you know, the bigger, most important thing was that my mom forced me to go to the VA. You know, she recognized that something was wrong. I was in denial about my PTSD and depression. You know, and when I got to the VA, I was welcomed in. You know, I was thanked for my service, and I ended up going back, I'd say on average, once a week for a couple of years. You know, and I just sat there and talked about not just my wartime experiences, but the stuff that I was struggling with then in the moment. And over time, it helped me to recognize my own signs and symptoms when I'm kind of falling into a funk, you know, before it gets to the point where I'm thinking about suicide. And it teaches you how you, on an individual basis, can kind of help to change your own mindset. You know, yes, I've received medication from the VA. I take it religiously, but it's the people at the VA, the doctors, the nurses, the social workers who really, really make the difference.
We asked Christopher what he thought after he saw the GAO report, which detailed the VA's recent failures on suicide prevention.
It's infuriating because this secretary and the last have said that their top clinical priority is suicide prevention. And the number one thing in order to prevent veterans from dying by suicide is getting them enrolled in the VA system and making sure that they get care. It's extremely frustrating because most of the veterans who die by suicide are not enrolled in the VA. And, you know, the VA will take any veteran who is feeling suicidal and will help them out.
Christopher says he saw the decline in awareness campaigns from the VA with his own eyes.
You could go onto VA's Facebook page and scroll back through 2016, and you're going to see an average of, I think, maybe one or two posts on suicide per day, you know, building awareness for the services that are out there and letting people know that, you know, trying to break the stigma, saying that PTSD is a normal person's reaction to an abnormal scenario. And then you go into 2017 and 2018 and it's just not there. It's a simple thing. They just didn't have someone running the PR operation. There were no commercials that were done. There's no billboards, you know, to reach rural veterans. There was no radio ads. It was just a complete drop off of the entire suicide awareness program.
And that makes a difference, he told us, because a lot of people just don't know about the help that's available to them through the VA.
This morning I woke up to a friend tagging me in a Twitter thread, and it was someone, you know, looking for help with a Marine who posted a suicide note on Reddit. And I've spent all of today trying to track down this Marine. And, you know, the first thing that I did was I called the Veterans Crisis Line. The second thing that I did was I called the San Francisco Police. It's sad that a lot of my friends aren't aware that those are the first two steps. You know, when you know that someone's suicidal, you call the Veterans Crisis Line. Even if you don't know who the person is, if you don't know the person well, if you don't have their name or location, you know, just getting that, the ball rolling and letting people know that there's someone out there that needs help, you can save a life. And, you know, I hope that I saved a life today. I don't know yet.
So looking forward, what can the VA do now to focus on getting out the word about suicide prevention?
Part of the biggest problem that exists at the VA is there's just way too much turnover at the top. You know, I understand the outrage that the general public and veterans feel when there's a failure at the VA and they want heads to roll. But if there's no continuity, you can never hold anyone accountable. You know, if you just keep firing people, there's no one there who, you know, it seems that they fired the people who were running the suicide prevention program, or at least those who were responsible for it. It's a terrible problem to have. It sounds weird to say that we need to hold on to a secretary even if there's a scandal, but that's the truth.
Christopher Goldsmith is Assistant Director for Policy on Government Affairs at Vietnam Veterans of America and an Iraq War veteran. And if you are a veteran and you need help, please call the Veterans Crisis Line by dialing 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 to talk to someone. It's the week between Christmas and the New Year, and that means many of you are probably shuttling to and from the homes of friends and family, driving from Christmas Day brunches to Christmas night parties, and maybe to a New Year's Eve night out or a New Year's Day toast. And it's likely that at some point between all of that zigging and zagging and delivering of presents, you'll have a drink, or maybe two. The sobering fact? Every holiday season, hundreds of Americans die because of drunk drivers. Over the past 5 years, an average of 300 people died in drunk driving crashes in this very week, the week between Christmas and New Year alone. And despite the fact that law enforcement is out in full force, the entire month of December is particularly dangerous. In December of 2016, 781 people died in drunk driving-related crashes. It's a hard thing to talk about, but we opened it up to you, our listeners, and you really surprised us with your honesty.
This is James from Alec, Oklahoma. When I was young, we all drove drunk and while drinking. The fact that quite a few young people from my small town were killed in accidents where alcohol was involved did not quite seem to sink in. I grew up and quit drinking. I was lucky.
I'm a recovering alcoholic, and when I was actively drinking, I drove drunk frequently. I also drank so heavily that I believed there was alcohol in my system almost 24 hours a day. So no matter what time of day I was driving, I believe I was under the influence of alcohol, and I caused a number of accidents. And I am really, really so glad that I am sober today.
This is Steve from Phoenixville, PA. I'm not proud to say that I have driven drunk about a half dozen times in my life. Fortunately for me, there were no consequences. I had a friend, on the other hand, who made a habit of it, did it every week for years and years on end. And for them, there were consequences. As for myself, I don't drink at all anymore, so not an issue.
Roberto is another listener who lived in Puerto Rico for the first half of his life. And he told us that he's driven drunk many times in the past. Roberto said, quote, "Drinking was an everyday thing. Going through the day having 5 or 6 beers was customary, and this was something I saw my father, uncles, cousins, and friends do. And even for those of you who haven't driven drunk yourselves, many of you know people who have or still do.
This is Christine calling from Seattle. Almost everyone around me has at least one DUI. The majority of them have 2 to 3 DUIs. They would meet up and hang out, have some drinks, talk about their DUIs, about the night they got caught, how much drinks they had, and their court dates, lawyers, jail time, almost like in a heroic way. And then they drive home after having multiple drinks, saying they're not drunk. I do not feel sorry for them at all. I do not understand why they keep doing what they're doing, but seeing them surely makes me not want to become one of them.
And many of you have found solutions or alternative ways to get home from a night out.
I did drive drunk when I was a teen, and there were no consequences because I never got caught. I do take steps to avoid drinking and driving now because I work an hour away from where I live, and were I to lose my license, I'd have no way to get to work because there's no public transport there. Also, I'm a pretty frugal person, and in New Jersey, the fine for drunk driving is a minimum $3,000, and I'd much rather have $3,000 than a drink any day.
Greetings from Amber in Worcester. The way that I avoid trouble with drinking and driving is I jog home from bars. Yes, I play music loud on my phone, or I chat with friends who are already at their place of rest for the evening, and I talk loudly as I jog or trot home. And in about 7 years, I've never had an issue. I always use good judgment.
There's one state that's looking to tackle drunk driving. On December 30th, the night before New Year's Eve, a new law will go into effect in Utah, making it the first state where it's illegal to drive with a blood alcohol level of 0.05 or higher. The rest of the country and D.C. use a 0.08 standard. Dr. Baron Lerner is a professor of medicine and population health at the New York University School of Medicine, and I talked to him about whether Utah's new rule could mean changes for the rest of the country.
Well, I think it's significant in two ways. One, I think is symbolic. We've been at 0.8 in this country for a long, long time and sort of got stopped there. Other countries have lower levels. So here's one state sort of symbolically saying we can do better. We're going to drop it. And also there should be benefits in Utah from people driving less in a buzz state, because really what you're talking about between 0.05 and 0.08 is what we might call buzz driving. So hopefully there's going to be a deterrence of that as well.
What does that translate to in terms of actual drinks? Because I think when people hear this, it seems very abstract. But does that mean, is 0.05 one glass of wine, two shots? What is it?
It's different in different people, which lends some people to say there's no way to measure that, and I think that's unfair. I think on average, 0.05 might be 2 to 3 drinks on an empty stomach. I would encourage people, if they're interested in this and they don't want to drive drunk or buzzed, it's very easy to get a breathalyzer and do a little experiment in your own house. But you're talking to get to 0.05, it's not just one drink and a meal. It's you're actually drinking in a substantial way.
So, I mean, is this bill, you said it's symbolic, but will this bill actually save lives? I'm sure that's part of the intent behind the bill.
It is, and I think you'd find different opinions because you're cranking numbers and it's speculative. There's some data from other countries to suggest that you would save lives. I've seen estimates, for example, if the entire United States went from 0.08 to 0.05, you might save something like 500 lives a year. I've seen that figure. But what you're also doing is not just saving lives. Again, you're deterring people from driving drunk in the first place. So you're preventing crashes, you're preventing injuries and that sort of thing as well.
Also, I want to talk a little bit about the history of getting this legal limit down to 0.08 in the United States, which is where we are outside of Utah.
It took a long time to do this. We were at 0.10 for a long time, which is really just way too high. People shouldn't be driving anywhere near that level. To get to 0.08, it took 4 years, and President Clinton at the time withheld federal highway funding from the states that were still at 0.10 to induce them to get their legislatures to pass bills saying we're going to lower it to 0.08 so they could get the money they needed to fix their highways. So it took some arm twisting to get there. And trust me, the alcohol and beverage industry was very much against it and fought it tooth and nail.
Also, want to talk about alcohol culture. We sort of talked about that before this segment. The United States has a pretty strong culture of drinking and just drinking, period. Is there something that we should start to think about changing there so we can avoid people driving and drinking?
I thought you were going to say we have a strong culture of drinking and driving.
I think that's the case too, right?
Yes, yeah. I think it's the case. What you said before about going to a bar, having a couple drinks, getting in the car, it's not going to be a problem. I do this all the time. I feel fine. That's very common here. It's estimated that, 115 million trips a year occur with someone intoxicated behind the wheel. Other countries take this much more seriously. We often talk about Australia, where there are breathalyzers in bars, there are breathalyzers on wine tours, and everybody breathalyzes before they get in their car to make sure it's safe. There are countries, for example, in Scandinavia and other parts of Europe where the blood alcohol level limit is 0.02. It's basically you have a drink and you get pulled over, you're going to get in trouble and you're going to get severe offenses. Those countries take it very seriously. And I will tell you that many of those countries are heavy drinking countries. If you think of Scandinavia, there's a lot of drinking there. So it's not that people are against drinking. It's if you're going to drink, come up with a different way to get home.
You were saying that there are some countries that you've experienced where the host of a party will actually ask who a designated driver is.
Right. It, for example, Sweden, that's commonplace. If you're going, for example, to a house party, the host will greet the two people if they came in a car and ask who's going to be the designated driver for the night and then make sure that they have a good time and have non-alcoholic beverages. I have been to lots of parties in this country. It's never happened once.
Let's talk a little bit about the drinking and driving itself. Is there a generational divide in who's drinking and driving? Are younger Americans more aware of the dangers?
Well, it's funny you ask that. I just got through teaching my undergrad class at NYU when one of the sessions is on drunk driving. And I asked, as I do every year, how many of these students, when they were in high school, got into a car with an impaired driver. And this year was, I have my hand up, but only about two of the 30 students did it this year. And we talked about it a little bit and they said, you know, this is one topic that they got hammered home in high school. You just don't do this. And to the degree that that's true, it's very encouraging.
What's unique here about Utah is obviously the Mormon faith in Utah might influence this decision as well, or might have influenced this decision. Do you see this taking hold outside of Utah?
Well, in Utah, if folks have visited there, I mean, there's a lot less alcohol in Utah in general. If you want to go find a bar in most places, it's pretty easy. It can be difficult even in Salt Lake City. I'm not thinking this is going to spread like wildfire at all. I think people are going to be paying attention to what's going on in Utah and seeing. I think if there's some data generated suggesting that this is lowering the rates of drunk driving and lowering the rates of deaths, states are going to look at it more closely. But I think in states besides Utah, this would meet with an enormous amount of opposition, and it may not be where state legislatures want to go.
It's obviously the holiday season. Any tips for people on drinking and driving or what they should avoid or just dealing with the pressures of alcohol generally?
Well, one of the biggest tips that I've learned about in studying this over the years is that think about where you're going and what you're about to do. Once you're tipsy or drunk, you're not going to make good decisions. So one of the teaching points here is set up your designated driver before. It's in the world of Uber and Lyft, it's way easier than it ever has been. So think about that you're likely going to drink, where you're going to be, how you need to get home, and how you're going to do that in advance.
Dr. Baron Lerner is a professor of medicine and population health at New York University School of Medicine. Doctor, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Holiday cheer wasn't enough to save a plunging stock market on Christmas Eve. According to Bloomberg, this Monday was the worst pre-Christmas day for the stock market on record, as the S&P 500 fell by nearly 3%. Adding to the tumult, on Monday, the president lashed out at the Federal Reserve under Chair Jerome Powell, tweeting, quote, "The only problem our economy has is the Fed." And he added that, quote, "The Fed is like a powerful golfer who can't score because he has no touch. He can't putt." The president's combative tweet came after Powell announced a move last week to raise short-term interest rates by a quarter of a percentage point. The new range is 2.25 to 2.5%, and it's the ninth increase since the end of 2015. The National Association of Realtors says this will nudge up mortgage rates. So, looking beyond the palace intrigue surrounding the Fed, what does this mean for current homeowners and future homebuyers? Megan McArdle is a columnist at The Washington Post, and she joins us now to break it all down. Thanks for being with us, Megan.
Thanks for having me.
So before we get into the specifics of the housing market, can you give us a quick overview of what's been happening to interest rates since the 2008 recession?
Right. So immediately as the 2008 recession, the financial crisis took hold, the Fed dropped interest rates down to zero and then started doing something called quantitative easing, which is basically kind of trying to push them almost past zero. That's a very gross oversimplification, but it's basically extremely expansionary monetary policy is what it's called. And that has held for basically almost a decade. And so what has happened is that, you know, the Fed has been saying, look, the economy is back on its feet. We can't just keep our monetary policy this loose forever. And so we have to start drawing back down, raising interest rates, drawing in our balance sheet. And the problem with that is, of course, that people had gotten used to very low interest rates, and they don't like it. But, you know, as the Fed has tightened, now we're still at a quite low interest rate by historical standards, to be clear. But it is not low compared to, say, 2013. So, you know, the president's very unhappy, obviously. But there are also implications for homeowners and other people who have debt, because, you know, when the Fed raises interest rates, when they tighten monetary policy, debt gets more expensive, and that has a ripple effect on all sorts of things.
Well, we have a caller who had some of her own concerns. Her name is Gail, and I want to play her call and get your thoughts on it.
I'm calling from Santa Rosa, California. The Fed interest rate hikes don't affect me very much because I have a 30-year fixed loan, and nothing's going to mess with that. But I do worry about my children who live in the Bay Area as well and their ability or willingness to get into the home buying market.
Megan, we just spoke about the being safe if you've got that fixed rate home mortgage loan. But Gail's worried about the next generation, her kids. Is she right to be concerned? Will this deter people from looking to buy right now?
Yes and no. There is a sense, there's actually not a lot of great empirical research on this, but there is a sense that when people go into the market to buy a house, they don't really actually look at the sticker price of the house. They look at their monthly payment. How much monthly payment can I afford? And so obviously, if interest rates are going up, then that monthly payment will get higher. However, there's also a sense in which, you know, that sticker price of the house is not set by some independent factor. It's set by what payment people who are in the likely market for your home can afford. And so what's actually most likely to happen is not that, you know, prices will stay the same and then mortgage rates will go up, making the whole thing more expensive. It's actually more likely that prices will fall to compensate for the fact that monthly payments are going up and that you'll end up with roughly about the same monthly payment, but that what you will end up with is homeowners losing some equity in their homes. So it's actually, funnily enough, probably the group that needs to worry most is homeowners. You also, though, have a problem of something that I personally have. We're in the middle of a massive renovation. And the reason that we're in the middle of a massive renovation is that, you know, our house has various issues. It's maybe a little too small for us. And so we looked at buying somewhere else. And what we realized was that because we bought in 2010 and have a 3% 15-year mortgage, you know, there's no way we can replicate that anywhere else. It's cheaper to borrow more money, even at a variable rate, and renovate the house we have than to move. Mm. And there are a lot of people in that position where you're going to get a certain amount of lock-in in the market because people who got mortgages at those crazy low rates, right, even if they moved and bought a house that's exactly the same price, their payment would go up a lot because their mortgage rate is so low right now. And so for those people, I think you're going to see less mobility, you know, in the next sort of, really, honestly, 10 to 15 years, because you'll never get those rates again.
Well, that's what happened. We had a listener from Pittsburgh who wrote to us about this issue, and this is what the listener had to say, and I'm quoting here. I'm concerned because we've got a home equity line of credit instead of a traditional mortgage. It has a variable interest rate and has been quite low since we took out the note in 2008 or so. Should our listener in Pittsburgh be concerned? I think the answer is yes, but you tell me.
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously you should be concerned, right? I'm concerned. I think about this quite frequently. And one thing that they can think about doing is looking into converting that into a fixed rate loan now before rates go up further. But you know what? The fact is we can't predict where rates are going to go. We could have a recession and rates could stop or even go backwards, right? It's very hard to predict which way things are going. And, you know, I would like to be able to say I think rates are going back to like 4 or 5%, not necessarily because I would like rates that high, but because I think that would be a signal to me that the economy is really robust, right? That we're really, you know, we raise rates and things are still okay. And I don't have that sign yet. But yeah, it is absolutely an area of concern for the listener. But at the same time, I think, you know, you don't know where rates are going to go. If we had a recession next year, rates would go back down.
Mm. What about renters? We talked about homeowners, home equity lines of credit. What about folks who aren't buying, but, you know, are these shifts also going to affect market rates at least?
Right. Well, renters may feel like they're not affected. And then the fact is their landlord has a mortgage, probably, which means their landlord is quite sensitive to interest rates, which means that things like how many homes are being built in the area are going to be sensitive to interest rates. And so, you know, if you're a renter, the supply of housing helps determine what your rent is. And so does your landlord's cost structure. Your landlord cannot basically just indefinitely continue to rent to you at a loss. And so both of those things are probably actually going to put a little upward pressure on rents, which is actually how this is supposed to work, right? The idea is that you're trying to keep the economy at a roughly even keel, producing at its capacity, but not above its capacity. So this is essentially what happens, right, is that when the economy overheats, inflation happens and people think that they're earning more for the work that they put in. And then they discover that prices have also gone up and they're not earning as much. And then they get less excited and they pull back. And so you want to run right where it can produce, but you don't want to kind of fool people into thinking they're richer than they are. And so the Fed's always walking that line back and forth, right across it. And so, you know, that is the difficulty, is that, you know, we don't know what it's going to look like. And, you know, to go back to the caller that we had, we don't know exactly whether the Fed's there or not. And we also don't know what's going to happen in, you know, 18 months when the economy could change and everything could be different.
Megan McArdle is a columnist at The Washington Post. Megan, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
Hey, Takeaway listeners, Amy Walter here, host of Politics with Amy Walter from The Takeaway. Every week, I'll take you beyond the headlines for a deeper understanding of how Washington works, who's pulling the levers of power, and how it all impacts you. I hope you'll check it out. Just search for Politics with Amy Walter in your podcast app and subscribe. Happy listening.